Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Well, my football friends, this is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pig Pen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a real treat for you tonight. We're going to go back about 40-some years into a very interesting league that not a lot of people know about the details of it, but you'll know about what we're talking about in a moment here. We have our guest who's just written a book about one of the teams. His name is Keith Wood. Keith, welcome to the Pig Pen.
Darren, I appreciate you having me on, man. I'm so excited to talk about some USL football and from the 1980s, and, you know, the Memphis Showboats were probably one of the better teams. And all your fans are going to know Reggie White, right? Let's just start with Reggie White, because when you talk Showboat football.
The Minister of Defense, everybody knows him, right?
Hey, the Minister of Defense. So for your fans out there, Reggie White's a Tennessee guy, grew up in Chattanooga, attends the University of Tennessee, All-American defensive end. And I'll tell you what, the USFL, not only did they grab three straight Heisman Trophy winning quarterbacks, Heisman Trophy winners, they also grabbed Reggie White. And in the 1980s, the USFL got the NFL's attention quick, fast, and in a hurry, right? Steve Young, Doug Flutie, Jim Kelly, Reggie White. The big names were signing for big bucks in spring football. And this league of David Dixon's, the spring idea of playing football. You know, most colleges, because we live down here in Memphis in SEC country, that's spring football season. And then here comes the USFL invading that territory and winning. And that's the key. The USFL put a quality product on the field, and they gave the NFL a run for their money.
Absolutely. Well, before we even get into that, let's dig into you a little bit. You know,
all right.
You told me when you came on earlier that you're actually not originally from that area. So I'm interested in hearing a little bit about how you got interested in writing about the Memphis team, and, you know, a little bit about your football background.
Right. So, first off, I'm a kid from upstate New York, played high school basketball, played a couple years in college, moved to Memphis in 94, and coached high school basketball for 17 years. When I got my dissertation and my PhD, I did it on Larry Finch. If for your fans that know basketball a little bit, he brought Memphis State to the 1973 NCAA championship game where they lost to Bill Walton. So that was my first book. My second book was on a Negro League baseball team in Memphis. And you're going to love this, Darren. I'm at lunch at Christian Brothers High School, and there are tons of CBAs around the country, LaSalle, CBA, St. Mary's, same group of Catholic brothers. And the English teacher that I had lunch with goes, "Wood, what's your next book?" And I went, "I don't know. Like, what do you think?" And he goes, "Man, I just read this Jeff Perlman book on football for a buck. You need to do something on the Showboats." So I read Perlman's book and I thought about it. And I went, you know what? Football absolutely has become America's pastime. And so jumped in as maybe not a Memphis, a son of Memphis, but an adopted son of Memphis. And man, just love telling this story.
Oh, I mean, that's great, especially when you're going, you know, halfway across the country from where you grew up, and you're absorbing into your atmosphere that you're living in. So that's awesome. So you have a little bit of coaching background and stuff in you too, right?
Right. So when I got down here, I was an assistant basketball coach at the high school I was hired at. There was a coaching change. My principal offered me the head job. I'm a head basketball coach at 25. And if you know anything about high school basketball in Memphis, it produces a lot of Division I guys. And the league I was in was an inner city league with a lot of guys that are going to have careers in Division I and a few NBA guys. So got broken, learned the ropes the hard way, but rebuilt the program and then moved to another school in the county, stayed there for 10 years. And just really enjoyed the relationships with the guys, right? People ask me if I miss coaching. I do. I miss with 2 minutes left on the clock in a huddle, having all the guys right there and being able to look in their eyes and know which one wants it and which one doesn't, because you can see that in a heartbeat. But I don't miss parents. I'm going to be honest. You know, the game, I haven't coached in 15 years, and this portal transfer paradigm, it's trickled down to high school athletics here in Memphis. I wouldn't miss that in any way, shape, or form. I love developing kids over time and watching them go from A to Z. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the successes. Weren't just in games won and banner song, but really in young men who developed as people, as citizens, who are now married with children. And in a lot of places, you wouldn't think that kids from those neighborhoods would have. So for me, coaching was that opportunity to connect and do what guys did for me in Schenectady, New York. I really remember three guys specifically that were my middle school basketball coach, my freshman coach, and my varsity coach. I still talk to them all the time, and I just wanted to return the favor and pass it forward.
That's awesome. I love that when you have great mentors and they can inspire you to carry on yourself to teach other youngsters on forward. So you just spoke a little bit about the portal and some of the modern era of the NIL and, you know, people switching teams. We have free agency in the pro sports and it's hard to follow a team, but you know, the team you're talking about, the Memphis Showboats, and actually let's take this opportunity. Why don't you tell the title of your book and where people can get it? And we'll mention again later.
Absolutely. The title of the book is The Memphis Showboats, the USFL team and the city's fight for major league status, right? So the book is available at Amazon. You can hit my website, which is www.keithbwoodauthor.com. I know it's lengthy. It's a domain I could get. I've got a Facebook page, Keith B. Wood Writes, and you can DM me there. And I can get you a copy that way, signed, sealed, delivered. Lots of ways to get the book. And really, you know, having that book out there, and McFarland is the publisher. You can go on their website, and they do a great job putting it out there. And so really, that's how you get the book, right? And so
And folks, if you missed it, you're driving or you can't, or you don't have a pencil and pen right now, we'll put it in the show notes of both the YouTube video and the podcast. We'll link you up and get you to Keith's book and get you connected here.
Appreciate that, Darren. Because you know what? I think when your fans sit down, you know, one of the football coaches at the school I work at, his dad was one of the first African-American football players at Memphis State. And he played himself with the Buccaneers and the Dolphins. And he was like, Coach, I got to get a copy of this book. I know these guys. Like, these guys are about 5-10 years older. And, you know, like one of the big stars for the Showboats is a local kid, receiver, Derek Crawford, who's a speedster at Memphis State and stays in Memphis with the Showboats in 84 and again in 85. leads the team in receptions at 84, also a kickoff return guy, gets a cup of water with the Niners in 86 when the USFL folds, right? So dudes that are local know this story. But like I said, guys like Reggie White have national appeal, the Minister of Defense. The quarterback was Walter Lewis. How about Paul Bear Bryant's first starting black quarterback is the quarterback for the Memphis Showboats. And we actually have a little bit of a quarterback controversy. Lewis gets hurt in 84. Mike Kelly, who had played for our head coach, Pepper Rogers at Georgia Tech, comes in, finishes up the last five, six games, does a great job. A little bit of tension starting in 85. Middle of the season, there's a four-game lull. Kelly replaces Lewis. So we've got it. I mean, we've got everything an NFL team has. We got quarterback controversy, baby. It's here. So if you're an Alabama fan, Walter Lewis, I mean, some great stories.
Yeah. So okay. So let's get into a little bit more about how. So we have a brand new league starting up, and it was kind of, you know, this is a big deal. They were advertising it. You know, there was other startup leagues. I think this was even a little bit bigger than the World Football League, which happened in the early 70s, and some other leagues that came here and there. But this one was really highly advertised. They said spring is ours, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to build a competitive league. How did they put together this team? How did they get the Walter Lewis's and the Reggie Whites and some of the others?
Absolutely. I think, Darren, you started with this, the World Football League in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Memphis had long sought after a NFL team. We were hosting exhibition games in the late 60s and the early 70s. And to be honest, Memphis got left at the altar a lot, quite frequently. And in 1973, John Bassett calls us and says, Canada won't take my World Football League team. Do you guys want it? And Memphians at the time were like, you know what? If the NFL doesn't really want us, sure. And so John Bassett comes down and he brings his Toronto Northmen and down. They become the Memphis Southmen or the Memphis Grizzlies of the World Football League. And Bassett does a great job. Elvis is at every game. Absolutely. Elvis is a Grizzlies fan through and through. Isaac Hayes, Shaft, he's at every game. Like, Bassett is this great, like the Bill Veeck of baseball. And so Bassett's in Memphis selling football, and he does pretty well. Now, he signs, I'll never remember this, Zonka, Kick, and Warfield off the 72 Dolphins. And so he's got more money than any other owner. 74, league collapses. Memphis is left at the altar again. So in 83, when David Dixon starts up the USFL, we're on the outside. But John Bassett has taken his talents to Tampa Bay, hired Steve Spurrier as the Bandits coach, right? And in between the 83 and 84 season, the USFL is looking to add 6 to 8 teams. And Bassett absolutely just campaigns for Memphis. He said, in the World Football League, I had more money than everybody else. In this USFL Football League, everybody else has more money. But Memphis, it's definitely a city you need to look at. And so locally, Alabama booster Logan Young is going to bankroll and campaign, go all the way to Denver when they have the first USFL championship game. And he's going to be like, look, we need a team. And so that's how the Memphis Showboats originates. And so Pepper Rogers comes on board and the Liberty Bowl is in, and it's really – the dynamics are working. But to be honest, Logan Young doesn't have that type of money. And so in January, Bassett picks up the phone and calls a good friend of his. And the friend is Billy Donovan. See, they played each other in tennis in the youth group coming up. right? The USTA versus the Canadian tennis. They're going back and forth. Well, Billy Donovan is one of the top five cotton producers in the world. He's the first cotton exchange guy to sell cotton with China through Richard Nixon. Wow. So when we talk about money, this guy has as much money as anybody in the USFL, including the general's owner, Donald Trump. And he might have more money at the time. So Billy Donovan buys the team on the recommendation of Johnny Bassett. And then once Donovan's in, Donovan loses $12 million the first year. And he goes, that's fine. He goes up to New York City, signs Steve Earhart, the number two in the league, to come to Memphis to be our GM, and then puts $20 million more on the table. And he says, Steve, build me an NFL roster. That's Memphis Showboats football.
Wow. That's amazing. So, okay, so how did they do this? Was it mostly coming out of the college draft? Were they taking guys off of NFL teams?
Right. So I had a great conversation with Carter Tate, who worked in the office the first and second year trying to get draft picks. And he said, you'd be surprised. A lot of the NFL scouts shared notes, shared where to go in SEC schools. Because, I mean, if you've never been to Starkville, Mississippi, especially in 1983, it can be an interesting experience, right? So, or Athens, Georgia, a lot of these places that these guys are going. So they had two drafts. They had a territorial draft, and then they had the USFL draft, which was a national thing. So we had a lot of schools, Tennessee State, Tennessee, UT Chat, Memphis, Arkansas, Ole Miss, right, were our territorial schools. Logan Young, I think, I'd have to go back and look, might have got us Alabama because of his connections there. And so then there's the big draft, right? And the key with the big draft is our draft took place before the NFL draft. So the USFL really was able to sign Herschel Walker. Right now, to be honest, Darren, I've read Perlman's book. I'm talking to Steve Earhart. He does the forward for my book. Steve was great. And he would be like, well, I was there when we signed Herschel Walker. And he goes, I'm going to give you a general idea. But he's not giving up details, right? Which is understandable because the NFL and the USFL is very cutthroat. And so you've got Herschel Walker, Reggie Collier, and Doug Flutie. I think Collier was the third Heisman Trophy winner. Really, the USFL, Steve Young, like bringing him to L.A. was huge. And now his contract looked good up front, but it was backside heavy. You know, when the Houston Gamblers, they get Jim Kelly in 84. I mean, that's it. Doug Williams takes the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to the NFC Championship game twice. And he just leaves and goes, you know what? I'm going to play in Oklahoma. And so he plays with the Oklahoma Outlaws for 2 years in the USFL. So there's some big names. And Memphis in 84, we've got an expansion roster. Let's be honest. We win seven games, which means we're 7-11. And the summer between 84 and 85, when Steve Earhart comes in, Earhart turned down three NFL clubs, five USFL clubs. I mean, he's highly sought after. And he comes in and he absolutely redoes the lineup, keeps the guys that can play. And Darren, here's the key. Steve always talked about this. When the USFL folded, the Showboats had 20 guys on the 85 roster, who 5 years later were still playing in the NFL.
Wow. So that's
so our 1B.
A little less than half the roster, probably, right? They're probably 50-man roster.
It was a 40-man roster.
40-man roster. So exactly 40-man half. Roster. Wow.
1 deep, 22, are NFL caliber. So there's a couple of guys. Bieslu comes in late. I think we picked him up from the Dolphins back in the backfield. And he gets in town and he goes, these DBs in Memphis are as good as what we had in Miami. I promise you, they're younger. They're younger. But in 2 to 3 years, these guys have more talent. So Steve does an incredible job lining the roster with NFL talent.
Yeah. Oh. So, I mean, I can't even – you don't even know, like, most NFL rosters today will have 20 guys playing 5 years from now, you know? Really,
is the average? Unbelievable. I think I looked this up recently, Darren. The average NFL career is 3.3 years.
Yeah.
And we got guys playing five, right? So when naysayers are like, well, the USFL didn't have NFL talent, they're crazy. Look at these lineups. Look at the rosters. Now, are we too deep? No, not a chance. But we're close. And I think, to be honest, if the USFL sticks to the plan and in 86 plays again in the spring, 87 plays in the spring, then 4 or 5 years down the line, by 90, the NFL, because of the number of players the USFL was taking, would have talked about an AFL-NFL merger. And they would have been talking that with the USFL in the same vein, right? Now, to be honest, you know, half the owners wanted to go play in the fall and go head up with the NFL. And Billy Donovan, he joined that group. He's like, well, you know what? If we're going to do it, let's do it. He was much quieter than, say, a Donald Trump was in New Jersey. He wasn't about the headlines. He believed that Earhart would put together an NFL roster, and he believed that the NFL would lose in this lawsuit. And so, you know, to fast forward to the 85 season ends, the Showboats lose in the semifinals to Bobby Hebert and the Oakland Invaders. And I know your fans are going to know this name because he burned RDBs. Chris Carter, mm-hmm. Minnesota Vikings. Yeah. He absolutely torched the Memphis Showboats that Sunday afternoon in Memphis. And it was a hot day. It was late June. And man, it was sultry. Like, the field was steaming. And AC, I watched the game. We couldn't stop him if we tried. We could put four dudes on him. And we couldn't get to Hebert in time. Reggie, they were double-teaming Reggie. So hats off to AC. Now let's keep going. In 86, they're setting up this lawsuit. Now Billy Donovan and some of the other owners are like, okay, we're in on the lawsuit. But do it in Memphis, because the argument was the USFL is a little brother. The NFL is breaking the Sherman Antitrust Act. Mm-hmm. And they're treating us like a stepchild, and they're not allowing us our rights as owners in the marketplace. They're probably right.
Yeah.
But yeah. Trump in New Jersey says, oh, no. I've got my lawyers. We're going to use our guys, and we're going to do it in New York City. And pretty much everybody I talked to said that if you had tried it in Memphis, because we've got a federal court in Memphis, right downtown, not too far from the Liberty Bowl, we would add a smaller judge, smaller courtroom, less press, without all the fanfare of people showing up in limos. Arguably, we would have won. And in fact, the NFL, when you read Roselle's biography, he talks about it. The NFL paid lawyers to do a mock trial. And Roselle was worried because in the mock trial, the USFL won.
Well, technically, they did win the court case. Yes, but they lost in the financial gain from it. Yes.
Lawyers danced around the issue and didn't. The jury thought that if they just gave the USFL $1, the judge could take that and do whatever. By law, the only thing the judge could do is treble it. So the USFL won $3. And so although the USFL wins, they lose. Now, here's a good one for your fans. Darren, what year did the NFL sign a contract with ESPN?
With ESPN? God, it had to be probably in the 90s, wasn't it?
86.
86, okay.
Right?
Well, so right out a year after that. All right.
Absolutely, right? So Chet Simmons, who was the first commissioner of the USFL, had been at the founding of ESPN. So the first thing he did was he signed ESPN and then ABC. Imagine the NFL without ESPN right now. What would the NFL look like without ESPN football? Sunday nights, Sports Center, the whole thing. Chet Simmons' vision to have ESPN really gave the USFL the money to go get the Heisman winners and to survive. Like, these guys have money, but you need TV money to compete with the NFL. And so when the USFL folds, ESPN quickly reaches out to the NFL. Roselle is savvy enough to sign the contract, and the rest is history. But really, the USFL with ESPN, here's another one. Great USFL ploy. The red flag. The review. The NFL in 84 and 85 were like, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. Part of the game is the human experience. The referees are human. In 85, the USFL tosses the red flag. And they're using instant replay from the whole season. And it really changes professional football. Good, bad, or indifferent. I'm sure some of your fans would like to go back. But, I mean, the kickers in the USFL use the tees, right? Lots of innovations galore in the whole league. And, in fact, for your viewers, I would suggest Paul Reith's book, R-E-E-T-H-S, on the USFL. He does a great job on the whole league. And I really, periodically throughout my research, I was in Paul's book really trying to understand the bigger picture, and he does a great job.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, what do you think? Okay, I'm trying to look at this, you know, the successful model you talked about was the AFL and the fourth AFL that in the 1960s ended up merging in 1969, right. You know, started the Super Bowls already. So
right.
They had basically a decade of building the fan bases out and same season as the NFL. So, you know, the Dallas Texans became the Kansas City Chiefs. They had a good, solid fan base in there. I don't think the USFL, you know, and I think taking your point, if they would have stayed in the spring, you know, a couple more years, maybe they would have got, you know, that point where they had the fan base. But the NFL, it's hard to go against a Dallas Cowboy fan base or a Green Bay Packers or these, you know, the Raiders or something, you know, these teams that have been around for decades. When you're a startup league and you've been around for 2 or 3 years, do you find that maybe that's the case too, that they tried to compete too early to merge?
Well, when the Grizzlies of the World Football League fell apart in 1974, Memphian started to look for, you know, the Boston Patriots before they moved to New England in the AFL. Like, we considered opening them. Robert Irsay with the Colts, who, you know, is absolutely a live wire, right? Like, Pete Rozelle probably would have gotten rid of Irsay as quick as he could. Irsay comes to Memphis, and he's probably got a pretty good deal to get to Indianapolis. And then in Indianapolis, you know, he's so sort of trying to work out a dome. So he plays Memphis like a fiddle a couple of times and really scars Memphians.
the guy that had spearheaded our 1970s NFL trip sort of thing, goes to Minnesota with the Vikings after we lose the when we choose the WFL over that. The New Orleans Saints, they actually, I forget the name of the senator from Louisiana, but he was able to quid pro quo offer Pete Rozelle an exemption from the Sherman Antitrust Act. And in the 1980s, before the Showboats get here, we are trying to do the same thing with a senator from Tennessee. So we're really trying all sorts of political routes, and really, you know, Memphis really gets this, you know, the weight on their shoulders. Like, why aren't we major league? And it's really an interesting phenomenon. It still carries forward today. You know, Memphis, the University of Memphis has tried to get into the SEC. They've tried to get into the Big 12. They tried to get into the Big East on the collegiate level. And then we keep getting stonewalled. And I mean, if you want to think about it, like Memphis had Billy Donovan in the 80s. We got Fred Smith. Now, Fred Smith just passed away this past year. But FedEx is in Memphis, Tennessee. The Orange Bowl in Miami has the FedEx name and money on it. Like, we've got FedEx money. Why can't we, we could bankroll a team. There's money here. Pitt Hyde with AutoZone. And really, it becomes, with the collapse of the Showboats, Memphis is left at the altar once again. It's really the story within the story. Because the book's really about the Showboats. But underlying that is this desire by the city of Memphis to be considered major league. And really, in our current moment, you know, we have an NBA team, the Memphis Grizzlies, a little different than the World Football League team, same moniker. Mm-hmm. And the word around town here in Memphis is that the Grizzlies are going to pick up and go to Nashville. So, mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember, Darren, do you remember when Bud Adams –
I was just gonna ask you about that.
Oh my gosh! Like,
yeah, that's because it was a Tennessee Oilers, and I was gonna say, was Memphis in the running over Nashville? You know, for the Oilers.
In the picture behind me on the screen, I've got a picture of the Liberty Bowl when the Showboats were playing in the 80s, and so mid 90s, mid to late 90s, when Bud Adams leaves Houston. He's going to take a stop in Memphis for 2 years. And then he's going to go to Nashville. Well, we all knew in Memphis that he was only going to be here for 2 years. Now, they come into the University of Memphis, which has a royal blue, and he paints the entire stadium oiler blue, powder blue.
The love you blue.
Memphis are like, what's this? This is ridiculous. Now, it got so bad that if your fans remember correctly, Pittsburgh Steelers fans on week 16 could fly to Memphis, get a ticket to the Liberty Bowl for cheaper than going to Three River Stadium. Mm-hmm. And they did. So the final home game of the Bud Adams era is nothing but black and yellow with the terrible towels. And Bud Adams gets so mad. He takes the team to Nashville and plays at Vanderbilt Stadium, which is incredibly small. Mm-hmm. So even then, there's like drama, misconceptions, like just this bad blood that Memphis feels because we're seen as minor league.
So, all right, you answered my question, because I was sitting there, I remember something with Memphis, and they were still called the Oilers for 2 years, the Tennessee right. Oilers. While they were there, it wasn't until they went to Nashville they became the Titans. Am I correct on that?
You're correct. Have you seen their new uniforms for this year?
No.
They're going back to the Bud Adams.
Are they?
Blue.
Are they?
Absolutely.
No, yep. Not the two-tone blue anymore, huh?
No, they're dishing that, and they're coming back with powder blue and – a symbol that looks a little bit like the Tennessee state flag, right? Which is, it's a red flag with a blue circle with three stars. So,
okay. Huh.
So interesting. Once again, there's not a lot of Memphians that drive the 3 hours in Nashville. Why? Like we, you could have been right here. Why are we going to drive to Nashville? Right. Like, so
right.
We get blacked out for Nashville, but I don't think many Memphians really are that concerned about it. You know, and it's part of the story of the NFL leaving us at the altar one too many times. So Memphians are like the Packers, the Patriots. There's not a real loyalty in Memphis because we've never really had our team since the Showboats, in essence. Yeah.
Wow. But what a heck of a team they had in there. So, Keith, you know, we are getting real low on time here to go this, but let's give it one more time. Your title of your book, where folks can get it, and, you know, maybe some last words.
Darren, I appreciate it. Number one, before I give you the name of the book and that again, where to find it. Thank you so much for having me on, man. This is a great story. The USFL is a great story in itself, and the story of the Memphis Showboats. There's some great players. We haven't even talked about Pepper Rodgers, the colorful coach yet, man. So there are so many great stories in there. I really hope your fans enjoy it. The name of the book again is The Memphis Showboats, the USFL team, and the city's fight for major league status. You can get it at Amazon.com. You can probably find it at Barnes & Noble. I haven't looked on there yet to see if it's there. The book came out April 1st or 2nd. And so, you know, the book's recently out, hot off the presses. If your fans want a copy, they can jump on my Facebook page, Keith B. Wood Writes, and can find me there. Or if they jump on my website, www.keithbwoodauthor.com. I can get them a signed copy for $30, and I'll personally pay the shipping and handling. Nice. Amazon's charging $40. So if you contact me personally, I'll give you the author's rate and cover the shipping and handling to get some of your fans out there and to get the story in their hand. Because, man, you can tell I'm excited. I just really love this story. And, man, I just, you know, can't wait to see how this plays out down the road.
Well, there you go, folks. You get 25% off and an autographed copy. So I get to talk to the man who wrote it. So that is an awesome offer and from an awesome guy on an awesome story. So, yeah, Keith, we really appreciate you tuning in and joining us tonight and telling the story. And we're not going to ask you too many questions, take you too many rabbit holes, because we want to leave something for them to enjoy in the book, too. So,
absolutely. Appreciate it.
So, all right, Keith. Well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Appreciate it, Darren. Thanks a lot. Have a good one, boss. Go Boats.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.